Hello. Here we are with another chat. Today, we fasten our seatbelts because it's going to be quite a ride. Here, among other things, you begin to glimpse something. But above all this pile of books that are dedicated to today's video, yes, this whole pile. That's why I say fasten your seatbelts, because, in short, the journey will be a very interesting and fascinating one. And I won't lie to you, seeing this pile of books comes to mind a verse from Giacomo Leopardi's Infinity, when he says, "Where almost my heart scares," because in reality, between preparing all this, remembering where I read certain things, then making some quotes by heart, I must say that I inevitably run the risk every now and then of maybe making some mistakes, some oversights. But I am sure you will forgive me. On the other hand, I am in good company as I think of Professor Menachem Cohen of the University of Tel Aviv, who has dedicated 30 years of his university career to find and correct the mistakes the Jewish authors made in writing the Bible. He has found between 1,500 and 2,000 of them. So let's say then that if they, the Jewish authors, made mistakes while writing in Hebrew, then if I do as well, perhaps you will amicably forgive me. Among other things, I also want to take the opportunity to mention something else. This channel that was opened during the first lockdown of 2020, and then we actually worked on it starting essentially from the summer. We are now at the end of the year, and it has now well exceeded 3 million views. So really, this is another reason to say, the heart fears, because in short, this charges me with some big responsibility. But I must say, a pleasant one, because, as you know, I share my curiosities, I share my doubts, I share my reasonings, and therefore, together, in friendship, we start reflecting on the things we read. And that is why I am, this time especially, surrounded by this mountain of books. So now let's start with this journey that will take us along a trajectory within which we will find many curious things that I have never talked about, and we will examine them in detail, because it is precisely in doing so that, once again, we are able to understand, or in any case, we can hypothesize, that if we pretend that the ancient authors, when they said something, they meant that, and wanted to transmit, especially for themselves, the memory of real events. Well, if we pretend. So if we use this method, we can perhaps understand many things that concern not only the past, but also the present. And so now, as they say, let's get started. Let's start by taking a journey that takes us very far in time and space. A journey that will allow us to have an overview of a period of time described in the Bible, but also in the apocryphal text. At a time in which, I do not hide from you, I would pay to be able to go back and be there to experience it, because in this period, some incredibly fascinating things were happening. Things that are all the more fascinating, the more we pretend that what they have written to us is true and that we are now going to read, even going into detail, because often all this is narrated under the veil of allegory, symbol, myth. It is judged almost as if we are a fable that does contain some element of truth, but that, essentially, is mostly all invention. On the other hand, if we do, as we will do now, an overview of all this, we will realize that perhaps reality goes far beyond the imagination of those who built on it. So I made you this drawing, this graphic representation, to put together the first Adamic patriarchs. I have already told you about the long life of these patriarchs, and therefore I will not go back to that specific theme because I have already explained the reasons. But there are one series of curiosities that are worth underlining. Among other things, you see that I have written some things in red because they are particular elements. So, we start from Adam. Here, obviously, there would also be Cain. But as regards to Cain, sorry for the bad handwriting. As far as Cain is concerned, I would say that it will perhaps be worthwhile to dedicate a special and specific video about him. I read you a couple of curiosities, one deriving from the Bible, the other deriving from Hebrew exegesis. You know that Cain, after killing Abel, is excluded from this tribal clan, and he says a curious thing. We are in Genesis 4:13, where Cain says, I will be a restless wanderer on earth, and whoever finds me will kill me. Now, if there were Cain and Abel, Adam and Eve, and Abel was already dead, one wonders, who is this someone who could kill Cain? And the Lord says that, in short, he puts a sign on Cain's face, so that no one actually kills him. We shall talk about this in the future. But who is this no one? According to what is the hypothesis that derives from the fact that the Adamites are a special ethnic group made with genetic engineering and cloning that we have already talked about, it is clear that Cain, once he leaves, finds himself in the middle, let's say, of the people who do not have the same characteristics as the Adamites and therefore are barbarians. And so Cain is afraid of being killed by them. Those who do not want or cannot accept these hypotheses say that, in reality, Cain is afraid of being killed by his own family members, in the sense that Adam and Eve must have had other children, and he is afraid of being killed by them. It is a little strange to think this, not so much as regards the family members, because there were certainly other family members. Just think of what the most important Jewish exegete Rashi says about this, based on the way they are formulated, both the birth of Cain and the one of Abel. Rashi says that, with Cain, a twin sister was born, and with Abel, two were born. Among other things, these twin births were typical. I have often talked about them in books. They were typical when the Elohim intervened to give birth to people, therefore, to make people conceive and give birth. So let's say that with this assisted procreation, twin births were very frequent, and therefore, this too fits perfectly with our hypothesis. It is clear, however, that if the Lord puts a sign on Cain's face, it becomes difficult to think that he put it so that his twin sisters would recognize him, because they obviously knew him, having been born with him. It was clear that they knew him, and therefore, would certainly not have been them to kill him. Even less plausible is the idea that he'd be afraid of being killed by beasts, because even if God had put a sign on Cain's face, the beasts certainly would not have recognized that sign, saying, "Let us not eat this one," as he has that particular sign. But, again, there are just a couple of curiosities that I wanted to include so as to understand the story. The ways in which it is told is actually less logical than how it appears if it is read in a slightly different way. But for now, let's leave Cain and follow the genealogy of the Adamites, the official one. Obviously, the Bible always tends to indicate the name of the firstborn of everyone. But every time it indicates the name of the firstborn and says, for example, after Adam, at the age of 130, had Seth, it says, and then he had other sons and other daughters. So it is with Seth after having Enosh, with Enosh after having Quenon, and so on. So this genealogy of Adamites is not really made up of a succession of characters that simply have to be added to each other in terms of age count, but they are characters who, given their long lives, were in reality all contemporary, as they were contemporary with all the sons and daughters that each of these had. So we have to imagine a population of Adamites made up of hundreds, if not thousands, of people. Because each of these had sons and daughters, and obviously each of those sons and daughters, in turn, reproduced. And therefore, this was a population that it was becoming more and more numerous. I have marked here Seth in Genesis 5:13 because a particular expression is used for the birth of Seth. Seth is the, so to speak, third son. Cain, Abel. Cain kills Abel and then is estranged, and Adam and Eve have this third son. When this third child is born, when God created Adam, he did it in the likeness of God. In Hebrew, we know there is the term Elohim. Male and female, he created them. That is, Adam and Eve, he blessed them. He called them man when they were created, i.e., Adam. When Adam was 130 years old, he bore a son in his own image and likeness. That is for Seth, and only for Seth. The same expression is used that was used for the manufacture of Adam and Eve, that is, in the image and likeness, which means, or at least let's put it this way, which leads us to think, authorizes us to think, that Seth too was produced with a particular intervention, because all of the children are born in the image and likeness of the two, or at least of one of the two parents. Here, exactly as for Adam, the need was felt to say that it was made in his image and likeness. When I spoke in the videos of Adam's fabrication, I explained that this formulation derives from the fact that it was made with the zelem of the Elohim, therefore with a genetic engineering intervention. Here, too, we can think that the same thing has happened. And therefore, there is perhaps a continuity of intervention, which would not surprise us at all. Then, when Adam, after 130 years of age, fathered other sons and daughters, he lived for 930 years. Here, already looking at this very simple graph, you see that Adam is coeval with Seth, Enosh, Quenon, Melil, Yared. Then there is the speech of Enoch that we treat on its own, coeval with Methuselah and Lamech, that is to the father of Noah. So it means that Adam died basically just before Noah was born. I would be inclined to say just before Noah was made. We'll talk about this later. So this is interesting. These ages must not be added to each other, but these ages must be superimposed, and therefore this is a long genealogy of people who knew each other, also because they probably lived together, let's say at least in the same territory. When Seth was 105, he fathered Enosh. And what happened in Enosh's time? I marked it, so you can go and see it. In Genesis 4:26, a very interesting statement is made. Seth also had a son, who he named Enosh. The people began to call the name of Yahweh. What does it mean? The name of Yahweh begins to be spoken at the time of Enosh. This obviously leads us to think that in the time of Seth, in the time of Cain, Abel, and in the beginning, in the time of Adam and Eve, he was not invoked. So when we talk about the Elohim, who made the Adamites, who intervened in the first place, that is, those Elohim who ruled the so-called Gan Eden, the name of Yahweh was not invoked. It appears later. Now, if we read the Bible carefully, we can also understand why. At this moment, that is, in this phase of the story, there was still evidently no need for, let's say, the direct intervention of the warrior Elohim, the military Elohim. We know that Yahweh is defined as Ish Melkama, meaning man of war. Here worked the Elohim, who produced both vegetable and animal food in Gan Eden. They experimented with food, and particularly they handled this new ethnic group that they had made to work for them. So in effect, the intervention of an Elohim with the characteristics of Yahweh would not even have been justified, so much so that it comes much later. So you see, Adam has Seth when he's 130. Seth begets Enosh when he's 105. That means that, at least for 235 years, Yahweh is, let's say, not known. He's certainly not called. He's certainly not invoked. He certainly does not participate in the operations that were conducted in the territory. And therefore, this already again gives us the idea of how this Yahweh is in reality just one of the many Elohim to whom a certain people has been entrusted, as we have already said, in particular, Jacob's family. So we have Seth, who is perhaps generated with genetic engineering. We have Cain and Abel, who are born with twin births, typical of assisted procreation. Enosh, at 90, generates Quenet, who at 70 generates Melil, who at 65 generates Yared, when at the beginning. Many years ago, I translated the Bible, since I knew that very often an important event is intrinsic within names. The root from which the name Yared derives, the verbal root, means to descend. And therefore, from the beginning, I have always had the idea that, in fact, the memory of a great descent, or at least an important descent, was invoked in that name. Also because later, Yared has Enoch, who later, we will see, was traveling with the Elohim, and we will see how he traveled. But for now, let us stop for a moment on Yared, because there is this important descent. Unfortunately, the Bible does not give us a direct account of that important descent. The Bible in Genesis tells us that at a certain point, the sons of the Elohim saw that the daughters of the Adam were tovot, that is, they were palpable. They were suitable for, and took as many of them as they wanted. If they took them as companions, if they took them as wives. However, the Bible does not tell us exactly when this happened. It simply makes us understand that it happened before Noah, because later, with the flood, and therefore with the saving of a single family, the Elohim intend to restore order in this situation that had become very confused, unacceptable, precisely as a result of these mixtures. Well, in Yared's time, it comes to mind, the name says, that there has been a great descent. And where do we find the description of the great descent? We find it in the Apocrypha of the Old Testament, in particular in the Book of the Watchers, where we speak of the, I say famous because surely most of you know the story. of the 200 rebel angels who came down to earth and took Adamite women. They take them as companions and teach them a whole range of things that they really should not have taught them, because that knowledge was to remain the prerogative of the Elohim. So let's hear what the Book of Watchers says. And it happened that the children of the Adamites who were born in those times increased, and beautiful-looking girls were born to them. So here I told you sons and daughters, and sons and daughters. So here we are in the hundreds, thousands. And these children of heaven saw them, fell in love with them, and said to among themselves, "Come, let us choose women among the children of the Adamites, and let us bear the children." And Samayaza told them that he was the leader. I fear that it may be that you do not want this to be done, and that I alone will pay the penalty for this great sin. That is, the boss says to them, "Okay, now we are talking about it. But then, since this thing should not happen, when the big bosses realize this, it turns out that I am the only one who pays." And they say, "No." And they all answered him. They told him, "We all swear and we pledge that we will not withdraw from this proposal and that we will implement it." So they make a deal. But the interesting thing comes here. Then all together swore, and all of them committed each other, and there were 200 in all. And they went down to Ardis, on the top of Mount Armon, and called it Mount Armon, because on it they had sworn. Well, and they went down to Ardis. Do you know what the notes say, starting from the studies of Cincello, a Byzantine scholar of the 8th and 9th century after Christ, that the reading descended into Ardis is wrong? So, starting from the Cincello and then authors, starting with the editor of this UTET publication, and then authors like Charles, Martin, Malik, Kinib, etc., they say that the reading in Ardis is wrong because, as can be clearly seen from Aramaic and then also based on the Greek, instead of reading "and they went down in Ardis," one has to read "and they came down to the time of Yared." Here is the descent, that descent that came to mind when, many years ago, reading Yared as the name in which an important event was set. Here in the note, it is defined and explained. It says that these angels came down at the time of Yared. That is, at the time of Yared, the children of the Elohim, that is, the children for who those think that Yahweh is God, the children of the only God. They came down, and among the hundreds of Adamite females, they chose for them how many they wanted. And here too, Rashi intervenes again, who says in his commentary on Genesis, the term "beautiful" is written like this to mean that when the daughters of the Adamites made a woman beautiful by adorning her to enter the wedding canopy, a powerful person entered and possesses her first. Do you know the Les Premia Noctis, which is still spoken of in the Middle Ages, when the gentleman on duty arrogated to himself the right, especially if the French wife was beautiful, to lie with her on the first night of the wedding? Well, here it is already spoken of as a use practiced here, practiced in this period. But beware. A powerful one entered and possessed her first. That is, therefore, one of the Elohim, one of the children of God. But we know very well that Elohim were not God. He entered and possessed them. But then, however, they also took them, often because they took them as wives, They took them as companions. Hear again what Rashi said, even married women, and then makes another statement that truly perplexes. Even married women, males, and animals. It's tough to digest. They took anything. It goes without saying that they were not too fussy, since for the children of the Elohim, it is often said that they meant the angels, that in the Melechaim. And when we say, but yes, it is a little like talking about the sex of angels. I must say that the sex of angels was very active, because they only used the jus premia noctis. But then they took married women, and they also took males and animals, and all this happened in this period, during which there was this important descent. And let's really imagine this period as one populated by hundreds of people, because we are normally conditioned, both directly and indirectly, by these simple names. Let's think about him. He's there. He's there. No. There are hundreds. The children of the Elohim come down and do what they want because they are powerful. And then, what happens is that, sorry, here in the middle of this heap of books, really my heart scares. Yared has this son named Enoch, and you see that Enoch has a particularity compared to the others. At 365, he leaves Earth, while for all the others, we have the age of death, 930, 912, 905, 910, 895, 777, 905 for Noah. At 365 years old, Enoch leaves and does not die. Enoch is among the undead, exactly like Elijah, exactly like Moses. I have already told you this in another video where Josephus speaks of Moses' departure. But this is among the undead because Enoch had very, very particular characteristics. However, since the direction they signal to me that we are passing a certain time, and I still have many things to tell you because, you see, it doesn't end here because this story now continues with this. It continues with this. But it is actually becoming too long, and it is never good to talk for too long, especially when you are on a merry-go-round with documentation that is important to follow calmly. I would do this. For now, I salute you, and we pick up everything very quickly in the next video. Bye. Thank you. Until next time.